about the nature of enlightenment. And I thought, for want of a better subject to talk about this evening, I thought I'd repeat some of the things which I said in that talk, in order that we at least can have some idea and appreciation on what is the goal of Buddhism and what isn't the goal of this practice. Sometimes that people will talk about the meaning of life, or when we talk about the idea of meaning, meaning also implies some sort of goal or some sort of purpose. And in the Buddhist religion, in that framework of understanding which we call the Dhamma of Buddhism, Dhamma being the word for truth or reality, that we have this thing called enlightenment or Nibbana as the goal, the apex, the culmination of life. One of the descriptions of monks and nuns, people who became fully enlightened, was to say that what had to be done has been done, that the meaning of life has been completed. So this evening's talk is going to be about enlightenment. It's a very difficult subject to talk about. Difficult because very few people wish to even comprehend the existence of such a thing. And if they do try and think about it, very often they miss the point. You may know, those of you who've read some of Buddhism and studied its scriptures, that when the Buddha himself was fully enlightened, that his first thought was that such an understanding, such wisdom, would be beyond people's understanding. And it would only trouble him too much to go around teaching it. And it was only with some reluctance that the Buddha started teaching about enlightenment. So it's, as they usually say, fools go in where angels fear to tread. So here I go, and we'll see how we go with this talk on the nature of enlightenment. But first of all, let's talk about what enlightenment is not. Because the reason I gave a talk at the Monastery at Serpentine was because of reading a magazine called What is Enlightenment? And being quite disgusted by its contents. Basically, that people in a modern age in United States and Europe and in Australia, they have this word now, enlightenment, and everyone wants to become enlightened, and everyone wants to enjoy life after they've become enlightened. Similar to a yearning of a young man who I know very well, it was me when I was a silly student. But once I thought that I wanted to become enlightened very quickly so I could get it out of the way and then go on enjoying my life. I had other things to do. And one sees these days that enlightenment has become very materialistic. Being enlightened. What I was reading in some of these articles is a sense of just being able to enjoy all of the pleasures the world has to offer you without any of the suffering which is involved. That finding some way of giving up the bad side effects of life and just keeping all of the pleasures at the same time. It's what we say in the English language is trying to have one's cake and eat it. Obviously, if you eat your cake, there's no cake left, which is the meaning of that simile. And it's asking the question, like, can one be fully enlightened? Can one escape from all the problems which we know so well in life, the disappointments, the frustrations, the anger, the depressions, the sickness, the death, the passing away of our friends? Can we have all of that? Or rather, can we have all the happiness without being affected by all that is suffering and disappointing? Now, some commentators say, yes, of course you can. And usually, the explanation which they give is in order to reach a sense of enlightenment, a sense of happiness, It was requiring a certain amount of surrender of the self, a surrender of the small self in order to try and merge with a bigger self, a sense of like the surrender of the individual to merge with something greater than yourself. And for many, that this becomes a goal of religion. For many, this becomes interpreted as an experience of enlightenment, a sense of loss of individuality, and a sense of becoming one with something far greater. Now, first of all, that I'd like to point out that whenever there is a sense of like surrender, there will always be a sense of happiness there. And that little bit of surrender happens in many common experiences of life. Even like playing for a soccer team, you are surrendering your little individuality for a team of 11. When you join any community, you're surrendering something of your own will to that of the group. Even soldiers who are joining an army, through surrendering their individuality and will, shown by the conformity of uniform and the following of orders, there is a sense of peace and freedom there. But I think you will all know, and I chose that simile very carefully, of an army, that such surrender, even though it does give you a sense of peace, of not having to think and debate the pros and cons of your actions, that it is a very dangerous surrender. And, unfortunately, that in our modern age, that there are many teachers, many religions, many cults which ask for that surrender. And indeed, they do get many converts. You ask, why on earth do people actually join these cults and these religions? The only answer is that there is a sense of happiness there, a sense of peace, which gets from the surrender of the individuality as it's given up to the larger group. And sometimes, but that's even with big religions, that you can surrender to a feeling of a God or a supreme being. And basically what you're surrendering to is some other person's idea of a supreme being. They're answering all your questions for you. And through your belief, through the surrendering of that questioning, through the surrendering of that doubting mind, you are getting a sense of peace, because you know what these questions are like inside of you. Sometimes it's so hard to find an answer. Sometimes it's so hard to find contentment. However, if you make that leap of faith into belief, there all questions are answered for you. There, the individual angst, the problem of being an individual in this world, is sublimated by the abandonment of yourself to the will of the group. However, not only is it dangerous, but it's not the full enlightenment. There is something much more than that. Indeed, that the happiness of the convert, the happiness of someone who has given themselves up to a supreme reality, whether that's a general in the army or whether that's the captain of the team, the happiness of the convert was recognized very, very early on by a wonderful quote, which I keep with me, from a English novelist and intellectual called George Bernard Shaw, who was an atheist. And as an atheist, that once he was asked, well, why don't you believe in God? Don't you know that people who believe are much happier than those who don't believe? And there's a lot of truth to that. People who believe in something now have got a sense of contentment, meaning, and they do appear happier. But this fellow, George Bernard Shaw, struck back straight away by saying, it is true, but the fact that the believer appears happier than the atheist is no more to the point than a drunken person appears happier than a sober one. And it's true, a drunk person does appear happier than a sober person. But why? And you can see there that even a drunken person has lost the sense of self-view. They lost the sense of being sensitivity to their own body, their own mind. Lost the questioning. They've surrendered something to the power of that drink. And it is no different, this George Bernard Shaw was saying, and I repeat this and concur, no different than a person who abandons themselves to a belief in some supreme deity, supreme in some idea of a cosmic consciousness, an Allah, a natural, the ground of all being, or anything else. That sense of surrender there is not the end of the story. Now, most people, they make that leap of faith, they give up something because of that reward of temporary happiness. And they justify that because there is some idea that this can be true. However, the way of Buddhist enlightenment, and I'd call it a way of enlightenment because I want to talk about the path before I talk about what the goal actually is, because the path gives some very important indications of what the goal is. The path of Buddhist enlightenment is not surrendering your will to somebody else. It's not surrendering your thinking processes to somebody else. It's not sort of giving up one self to gain another self, even though it may be more refined, more lofty, more idealistic. And in Buddhism, we certainly warn everybody to be careful of giving your responsibility to somebody else. It's just a path which slides into immorality, to hurt to yourself and in the community, that if you just give up your responsibility to someone else. And I saw this as a young student when I was investigating the different religions of the world before I became a Buddhist. I thought it was the only fair thing to do if I was going to choose a religion in the world to at least investigate those on offer. And one of the things which really struck me was when I read one of the holy books of Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita, and some of you may have known that that religious work. What really struck me and what I always remember was where the hero of that song, that poem, Arjuna, was about to go into battle against his brothers. There was a war going on. And that he had some moral qualms, even though that he was a soldier, even though the battle was about to begin. There on the opposite side were brothers, his own kin, and he thought it was wrong to go and kill them. But at his side was Krishna, who told him that, what do you mean killing? If every being is the absolute reality, is Brahman, how can you kill anybody? He said that just killing is just an illusion. And from that point on, that even as a young man, I saw just the fact that such ideas of ultimate reality being giving yourself up to a being, to a supreme being, that thinking that you are the cosmic consciousness and cosmic consciousness is you, will actually lead to giving up of the basic virtuous moral codes of compassion and harmlessness. You actually justify it. It's not me doing it. It's the Supreme Being doing it. It's not my fault. This is just the play of the cosmic consciousness, the battles, the anger, the hurt, This is just the way things are. Thereby, very neatly giving up all moral responsibility for one's own actions. And to me, that never made sense. Now, the alternative to leaping to the faith in some sort of cosmic consciousness, giving up one's sense of responsibility to someone else, is to take full responsibility for one's actions of body, speech, and mind, which is where we begin with the path of Buddhism, which is supposed to lead to enlightenment, that you are responsible for your happiness, and you're also responsible for your pain and suffering. The Buddha was saying that you make your suffering, no one else does, and you make your happiness, no one else does. This is basically the law of karma. It puts you in control. And so what that means is that just for your own sake, you become virtuous and moral. That if you want to be happy, you have to make that happiness. And if you suffer, you've got no one to blame other than yourself. And this is a very clear sort of teaching, but it is something which people refuse to accept. Even these days when we have the victim psychology, where people do not take responsibility for their actions, but they blame their upbringing, they blame their parents, they blame somebody else, anyone else but me. And as such, it means that the person will never be solving the problem where they can really do some work, where they can really do some help. Now, even if your parents did abuse you as a child, even if you had a terrible upbringing, you cannot change that. But what you can change is your attitude to your past and your responsibility to your present and future. That's what you can change. I remember my father telling me about his father. It was my grandfather, paternal grandfather, who I never met because he died during the Second World War in Liverpool. And please excuse me for this word, but I'm just repeating what my father told me. He called his father, my grandfather, he called him a bastard. And he called him this in front of me as he described some of the things he would do. He was a plumber, and he would come home in the evening after going to the pub drunk, and he would hit his wife, my father's mum, and then he would just take his belt and just whatever char was in the way. He was drunk. And that's why my father never got any love from this man, and he never respected him at all. My father was an abused child. However, I remember my father telling me about his childhood and said that because of that abuse which he had received, and because he saw just the pain and the terror which it caused in the household, when father came home drunk, the kids had to scarper to get away, otherwise they get the end of the belt for no reason at all. And his poor mother, who could not escape. Because he saw that, from a very early age, he made a resolve that if ever he gets married and has children, he would never do such things. Instead of being burdened by that experience, that he learned from that experience, instead of blaming somebody, he took responsibility to be a much better person than he'd seen as his role model. You can do this. This is taking responsibility. Even people who have had such difficult experiences, such troubled times, you can always do that which is good. You can change, you can be responsibility. You can be responsible. Now, this is the first thing which Buddhism is teaching people. The law of karma gives you the ingredients of your life. Sometimes those ingredients are poor, sometimes those ingredients are rich. But what you do with that is really up to you. The karma you're doing right now is important. So whatever's happened to you, good or bad, the question which Buddhism always asks you is, what are you doing about it now? And you can always do something about it. The first thing is taking responsibility, not giving responsibility away. And the second thing is this always asking those questions. But as you ask the questions, the big questions of life, the big questions about the nature of the world, the questions about God, about soul, the nature of life, you find that those questions which you ask, which you're encouraged to ask, eventually just reach a place where you experience that that particular way of answering the questions, you don't abandon the questions, but you start to suspect that the way of finding an answer may be a cul-de-sac, using thought, questioning, concepts to try and find the answer. You find you get nowhere. The great philosophers of our times, the people who have incredible intelligence, they questioned and questioned, and they never got anywhere. Again, I went to a good university where there were great philosophers and where there were great scientists as well. You know, one of the reasons why I gave up following the path of science was when that one of my lecturers, one of the tutors who I got to know very well, was having a divorce, a breakup from his marriage. And he was a very intelligent person, far more intelligent than me, but he was suffering terribly. And sometimes I asked myself, as a student, what is the use of such intelligence that you can write great papers on the nature of the electron when you're suffering and can't sleep at night and going to get drunk because you cannot work out the meaning of life? There's something wrong there. And I see that even today, that last week someone was discussing with me just the prevalence these days, not of religious views and ideas. Basically, Christianity, Islam, sort of even Buddhism, it's not important in our society. What is important is science. Like, science is the great religion of our time. And someone like Stephen Hawking can go and say something about the nature of the universe and be taken as an authority without question by thousands of people, millions of people. Now, his book which he wrote, A Brief History of Time, even though people don't really understand it, they read it and they quote it and they believe in the Big Bangs and goodness knows what else, even though it's completely beyond their experience, beyond their understanding. And I was mentioning just last week in a discussion with someone about this. He said, well, look, you're under the impression that science works. I mean, that was his basic argument, that we should believe in science because science works. Sure, it does, in the sense that you can turn on your television from a distance and it turns on and it works. And you can have a computer which works. Does it always work? Now, how often does it crash? How often do you find difficulty with these things? But does it really work? What I was saying when I was at Cambridge, that science was not working. In other words, it was not creating happiness. It was not creating that understanding which solved the real problems of life. Okay, you can make a television work. So what when you're going through a divorce? Okay, you can have these amazing computers which can do all these amazing things. But is that really relevant when you're dying? Okay, you can sort of have a great database of all the criminal occurrences in Perth. But does that really cut any ice when a thief breaks into your home? You know, there's a problem there. There's a difficulty in society. There's a difficulty in people's behavior. There's a difficulty in people's happiness. Somebody was telling me the other day, I haven't read the newspapers or seen the television, there was some two children in Arkansas or something who stood outside the school and just machine gunned little children. Science is not working. Can there be another worldview, another way of looking at life? And again, I keep on saying this, the reason why science doesn't work, the reason why that there is such problems which arise from basically accepting a materialistic scientific view of the world, that it does not accept, it does not include the world of the mind, the experiencer, the feeler, the doer. It's what you feel about this. Sometimes people argue that the mind is part of the brain, or they wonder where the mind exists. That's not the problem. The problem is that people are suffering, they're hurting, they're confused. They have a lack of understanding about life, its meaning, a goal, what this thing is all about, what death is all about, what birth is about, what relationships are about. There's an incredible amount of confusion in each one of your minds, let alone out there in the world, about what these things actually are and what you should be doing about these things. Where do these problems live? They don't live in the computer. It's not the computer is the problem, it's the person operating it. It's not so much the computer crashes, it's the operator crashes into depression, into anger. There's a problem there. It's because that the science just marginalizes the mind as if it's something unimportant. Now, the way towards enlightenment, you have these questions and you want to find some answer to them. Please excuse me for doing this simile once again here, but it's the best simile which I have ever had. I always pick up something, hold it up, and ask you, what is this? This is an experiment, this is a simile to make a point. You watch your mind as I say, what is this? And you come up with all of these words, concepts, thoughts, stick, it's covered with a bit of cloth, it's used for ringing the gong. Ajahn Brahm uses it every Friday evening, three times, and I've got to come out of meditation. Look at this, what is it? And watch your mind when you go through the inquiry of understanding what I'm holding up here. What usually happens for most people is the first thing which comes up in their mind, stick. They stop there, they think they know it, the problem solved, and they go on to something else. Now I ask you, is this a stick? Look a bit deeper. Is there anything else in this? Now as you look deeper, you find other concepts come up. It's wood, it's varnish, it's about 10 inches long. You find out that as you watch yourself going through this process of inquiry into the nature of a stick, you find out that what you're actually doing is you're not really looking at this stick. What's actually happening in your mind is just you're recalling all of those old experiences, labels, perceptions in your encyclopedia, in your database, comparing it to what you're seeing here. And the experiment which you should do is to be able to hold something as simple as a stick and inquiring into its meaning, what it actually is, to go at least as far as you run out of labels. As you run out of thoughts, you exhaust all of your repertoire of descriptions to this thing which I'm holding up. As some people, if they've been to universities, it takes a long time because they know so much about a stick. And sometimes they think they're experts on sticks, and they got degrees in stickology. And they're the ones who it takes a long time to find out that actually even something as simple as this, they don't know what it is. Can you really define this by all these words and labels which go through your minds? Does this completely exhaust the nature of something as simple as a stick? You find it doesn't. If you can do this experiment, and I encourage you to do this from time to time in quiet sort of moments in your life, if you have such quiet moments, take up something very simple, just watch it, and just exhaust all of your labels, and then keep looking. Then you actually find things which you've never seen in this before. You're looking with fresh eyes. Then you're actually starting to see it. Only when you stop thinking about it. That's how you find out about the nature of a stick. Now, suppose you want to find out some really important questions in life. You start out by asking, by thinking, and you find you get nowhere. You may hope that some other people, some experts, might help you with your thinking. You come and listen to talks on Buddhism, or you only go off to the synagogue and hear some talks on the Kabbalah, or you go out to some other expert in the field who gives some very brilliant talks on all aspects of the mind, being, nature of the world, or whatever. But after a while, again, that doesn't really help you. That's just giving you more labels to define your stick. After a while, you have to sit by yourself, just in the loneliness of your own experience. I like that word, the loneliness of your own experience. When you exhaust all that you've ever been taught, all that you've ever learnt, and all that you've ever known and trusted, that's when you can start seeing what a stick truly is. We always have a simile of like truth being hidden behind a curtain, like enlightenment of being like covered up. Now that curtain you can actually know as being your thoughts. It's actually all your thoughts and ideas. Your whole concept of the world is all old knowledge, old ideas, old perceptions. It's that which is stopping you seeing reality. It's simple, really. You go to a restaurant, they're serving Thai food, say. You say, I don't like Thai food, it's too spicy. How do you know? Sometimes you never tasted Thai food. You may have tasted some other food which you've got which was spicy. So often that we don't even try that food, because we think, I don't like that food. Sometimes we see a person, I don't like that person. And we haven't even really met them yet. Sometimes overseas, to go to India. India is a really dirty place, I don't want to go to India. But you've never even been there. How do you know? You see that sometimes all that old knowledge, just how it prevents you seeing reality. Even, and this is with relationships, how much old knowledge do you carry around about people? So much so that you've already got it fixed in your mind that that person, say, is incompetent. That person is cruel. That person is angry. And so often, if you have that fixed idea of a person, that old knowledge, whenever you see them, actually that's what you're looking for. You're looking for something which they say or do which confirms that, yeah, they are angry. Yeah, they are incompetent. Yeah, they are hopeless. Doesn't matter all the good things they may be doing. That you don't see. Just the one mistake, there, they are incompetent. Be careful of your old ideas. Because if you have your old ideas when you're looking at another person, you really think you know them, and basically you're putting them in a box, and you are creating them. It's marvelous to uncreate another person. See the person you live with. See if you can uncreate them. In other words, put aside all your ideas of who they are, all of your past history of your relationships with that person. And it's amazing that only then can you see new things in that person, just the same way you can see new things in the stick. If you want to have a vibrant relationship, you want to see something new in the other person you've been living with for years, try that. Put all the ideas of that person aside and see if you can see something else in them that you've never seen before. Now, this way of looking, which is beyond thought, to be able to see new knowledge, do you recognize that? It's called meditation. You can't get away from meditation in Buddhism. It's a central pillar of the whole system. What actually you're doing in meditation, with your present moment awareness, stillness, can you do that? Can you actually be silent inside and not say anything? Only when you can train yourself to put aside the old knowledge, which we call thinking, can you actually start to see anew. Only then can you start to see things which you don't expect to see. This is a problem. When we expect to find something, sure enough, we'll find it there. When you don't know what to expect, when you're fully open, then you can start to see things which would otherwise shock and disturb you. There's one of the great sayings about insight, true knowledge. That true knowledge doesn't confirm your old ideas, but it shatters them. True knowledge is not just an extension of all of your views and thoughts which you have now. The insight, powerful insight, completely transforms the way you look at life. Now, if you want to find out about the nature of the mind, this is a self or a soul. Where's it going to live? It's going to live in the mind there. If you want to find out about the nature of life, if you want to find out about the nature of a God, this is what you've got to do. Quiet your mind down. Shut up and look. Once you start doing this, you find out some very strange things. You start to become wise. And this is wisdom which is not coming from somebody else. It's not surrendering to some tradition or some outside teachings. This is wisdom which is coming right from the heart, as they say. You know, one of the first things you see is just how little you own in life. What do you really have in life? People think that they own their house, their car, their bank account, and their debts. It's nice to know that really this doesn't belong to you at all. It belongs to nature. A house, even though you may have the title deeds, and you think you've paid off the mortgage, and you think you own it, it's owned by nature. Just wait till a bushfire or tornado or a big bomb blows it all apart. And it proves it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to nature. Nature is the owner of all your car. Do you really own your car? One day it might crash. And when it crashes, when it stops, when it breaks down, do you get upset? Do you think that this shouldn't have happened? If I only just bought it a week ago, I'm going to really get that second-hand car dealer. Do you really get upset? You only get upset, you suffer when you don't know the reality of the situation. The reality is your car belongs to nature. Even new ones can break down, can crash, can be stolen at any moment. And houses, no matter how big they are, no matter how many rooms and how well they're fortified, they can go at any time. And let alone those possessions, even your own body, it can go at any time. Do you own even your own body? Sometimes we think we have rights over my own body. Can you choose when you're going to die? Can you choose to be sick or not to be sick? Or is this body also just belonging to nature? Of course, the truth is not what we want to hear. This is the problem with truth, because people always think that truth is nice. Truth is challenging. Truth is like going to a dentist. It hurts at the time, but it's nice after you come out. You're getting rid of a pain, and you feel much better afterwards. So the nature owns this body. All this material world belongs to nature. And when nature wants it to, it will take it back. And basically, you've got very little say in the matter. Once you understand that, it makes life much more peaceful. Because it means that when, for one reason or another, that possessions disappear, or they come, or they go, you don't get so upset. Translated, you're not attached to these material things. You're just renting them from nature. Your own body, let alone someone else's body, when they disappear, you think you own your partner because you signed some marriage contract with them. But when nature takes them away, they take them away. When nature takes away your body, or your health, or your wisdom, it's nature. You only rent these things. What this means is that you are willing to let them go once you realize you don't own these things. Have you ever noticed that those beings in the world who have been truly wise own very little? I always doubt people who are enlightened who go around in Rolls Royces or who live in big houses. There's something wrong there somewhere. Or enlightened beings who charge money to go and listen to their talks. There's something very wrong there. Because part of being enlightened is realizing you own very little, if anything at all. Now, you ever notice that what ownership really is? Why do people actually buy fancy cars? Why do people buy like these big sports cars when they know the speed limit is the same for a big flashy Porsche and an old bomb of a Toyota Corolla, and that sometimes they both get stuck in the traffic jams side by side and you can't go faster? What is the purpose of buying a big sports car except to say, look at me? What is the purpose of buying a big house except to say, look how well I'm doing? Isn't a lot of our possessions something to do with our sense of ego and self? And isn't it so, the richer a person is, generally speaking, the more ego they have? Isn't it sometimes the case that we build up ourselves with the bricks of our possessions? This is sometimes why that people seek comfort in possessions, because they think that thereby they're expressing their identity. But really, you're just expressing your stupidity. How hard it is to work for all those possessions. And how much you have to worry about them. Isn't it nice and wonderful to have an old bomb of a car which you can leave anywhere and you know no one's going to pinch? It is because that the actions are connected together. That when you realize through wisdom that you don't own anything, at the same time as tending towards simplicity, you are also tending towards wisdom. You just use what you need in life and no more. And you go through life, as they say, light, like my favorite simile, like a bird. The birds are very beautiful similes in Buddhism because wherever they go, they never take any suitcases. I never see them with a backpack on when they're flying from place to place. Just how wonderful it would be to be a bird, having no possessions, or very few, so that you have nothing to worry about, nothing to look after, nothing to ensure, nothing to keep mending. Now, can you get some idea of enlightenment, the freedom from possessions? You don't have to have no possessions at all. You just have to realize that when you do get anything, it is not mine. It's there that people buy into suffering, when they think that this is my child, this is my wife, my husband, this is my car, this is my arm, this is my leg, this is my body. That's when you're asking for trouble, because someday that's going to be taken away from you. You say, don't go, it's mine, I own this. And nature says, sorry, it's mine, says nature. If you can understand that much, you'll be free from a lot of suffering. This is something which you notice when you stop thinking, because this is something which we don't want to face up to. We have to be so quiet and so still that the truth can actually sneak up and teach us something. The way towards Buddhist enlightenment is through letting go of thinking we own things. But that doesn't, Buddhism, it doesn't stop with thinking we own things in the world. Even like our ideas. Do you own your ideas? There's something now which they've got, again, starting in America, called intellectual property. So all the jokes I've told over the years, if you tell them again, I'll sue you for pitching my intellectual property. I think they won't sort of class it as intellectual anyway, so. We have this thing like we call, like, as if our ideas belong to me. What happens when we think that it's my idea? When we get so proud about it, we want to make sure that my idea wins. Now, you know, when we think it's my idea, that's when you get arguments in the home. I'm right, you're wrong. It's just an idea, that's all. It belongs to nature. Thoughts which come up in the mind are just like that. They come up and they go again. Do you own your thoughts? Do they belong to you? Ask that question. They don't belong to you at all. No more than you own the wind. Thoughts. It's a very beautiful simile. I just like the wind. Because the wind, you don't know where it comes from. And all you can know about the wind is just feeling it when it passes you. And then where it goes, you can never tell. It's the thoughts, just like the wind. They come and touch the mind. You don't know where they come from. And then they're gone. You don't know where. Just wind touching the mind. The thoughts going through the mind. Now, if you could understand you don't own the thoughts, then you'd be able to let them go. And you wouldn't be someone who continually thinks as a reaction to a problem in life. So much of the suffering is not really concerned with the possessions or the body, the material things of life. So much of the suffering people experience in life is the internal suffering, when they think they own their thoughts, to the point they won't let them go. The thought of the past, they have to nurture and keep. And it tortures them. We won't let them go at all. Silence is just so wonderful and beautiful when you can let all the thoughts go. Just like you imagine just the images of enlightened beings becoming enlightened in the desert. Silent place, empty place. Well, why is like in the middle of the ocean just such a marvelous, peaceful place to be? There's nothing happening there. There's no one there. Up on top of a mountain, because you see space all around you. There's nothing. Silence. Why do we keep thoughts? Why do we nurture them? It's because we think we own them. They're mine. They're my thoughts. If you can look at thoughts just like being wind, you don't own it. Then you find you can let them go. Then you find that you can rest in silence. Then you can find that you're getting very close once that curtain of thoughts has been removed. Then you can get very close to this silence which you experience, which you feel, which you know. You can know without thinking. Very few people haven't had that experience, to be fully knowing without having the words to describe what's going on. The silent knowing. When you get into the silent knowing, what you're coming close to is the nature of the mind. The mind is that which knows. The mind is also what reacts to what it knows and goes out and does things in the world and just makes such a mess. You start to get to understand the mind which doesn't react, but which is still, which can know the world and just be peaceful with no reaction. The mind which can absorb